This week, we finish up the two-part series on the fourth part of a circle. We move from the astrological into the lodge and the unity of all people. Then, we hear from Brian L. Pettis, 33rd degree. What exactly is the Rough Ashlar, and are we truly working on it, or just backpatting? All this and more. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back to the show. This is episode number 464. In the news, just want to mention that MasonicCon Chicago is all done. It's over. Yay! It was a great event. We did really well. And if you want to know more, you can read the review on the Midnight Freemasons blog. I'll put a link in the show notes for that. My thanks goes out to all our presenters and Spencer Hammond, who did all the artwork, and of course all the support of my Lodge brothers at Space Novum Lodge, particularly Scott Duball, Gary Meisner, and Spencer Hammond. This week, as you heard in the top of the show, we've got some great stuff coming up, and we should probably just get right into it. So last week, I actually ended the reading almost mid-sentence. And so I will start at the sentence that I actually broke off on. It really wasn't intentional. I thought that was the end of the sentence. However, it wasn't. So my mistake. And I'll start at the top of that sentence and finish out this paper, which of course is the continuation of the fourth part of a circle. From the Dormer Masonic Study Circle, Transactions Number 94 by Worshipful Brother J.D. Blakely, from Essex, a Past Master, Lodge Number 5184. This is our Circle of the Zodiac. In our ritual, we refer to the Brethren of the North, East, South, and West. We'll take notice that Mr. Blank is about to pass in view before them to show that Blank, and is a fit and proper person to be made a Mason. And we have the same proclamation to the four points of the compasses early in the coronation ceremony of the monarch of the British Commonwealth of Nations. While we are inclined to think that the Master is calling on the members assembled in the lodge to quote-unquote notice Mr. Blank, is it not far more likely that he really is calling on the four regents of the world, with their attendant hosts, to witness that another human being is seeking guidance toward the first rung of the great ladder which reaches from earth to the heavens? In his great work, The Light of Asia, Sir Edwin Arnold says, "But when they brought the painted palanquin to fetch him home, the bearers of the poles were the four regents of earth come down from Mount Sumeru, they who write men's deeds on brazen plates." We have seen that in the Book of Enoch, the four regents are given the names respectively of Michael, Raphael, Gabriel, Fanuel, or Haniel. The name Michael means, "who is like unto God." That of Raphael means the healing of God, Gabriel means the strength of God, or the man God, and Fanuel, or Haniel, means the grace of God. You will notice that Raphael corresponds to the physician, the healer, and that the name Fanuel, Haniel, is very similar to that of St. John, Fan or Han. We still have the Scottish names of Ian and its related variations in other countries, examples being Hans, Johans, each with a similar meaning. St. John is the mystic, the visionary. He is associated with the North, the place of material darkness, which is but spiritual light, the symbol of spiritual vision and aspiration. But directly, at the opposite end of the axis, is the evangelist, St. Luke, the physician, the symbol of the great regent Raphael, who heals the wounds of those mortals who, during their upward climb on the way of return, quote-unquote, fall among thieves. It is not appropriate that the junior warden should be situated in the place of the physician, for it is he who calls us from labor to refreshment, but only that after being refreshed. We should be the better able to continue the great work, for he warns us to, quote-unquote, keep within blank for the further dispatch of Masonic business, end quote. You will be familiar with the symbol of the Buddha in contemplation with his hands showing the sign of the opposite triangles in perfect balance, the balance of the horizontal axis of the cross, the balance of the material sense, nature, and the inward spiritual or soul nature, the balanced food of bread and water, for the twain are but the life-giving food for ourselves. In the account of the mysteries of Mithra, the sun god, we are told that the symbol of boundless time was placed at the pinnacle of the divine hierarchy, and that it was represented as the figure of man with the head of a lion. Round the body, coiled anti-clockwise, was a serpent with its head looking down onto the top of the head of the lion, which was a key. Here we have the symbol of ascent anti-clockwise along a spiral path from Aquarius, the waterman, to Leo, the supreme man. The key was a golden one, indicating that boundless time is the key to the mystery of existence. It is the key of Peter, who, like the lion, is represented as having long flowing hair. He was the lion of the 12, the symbol of the lion of Judah, the crown. This is the symbol of the vertical axis of the cross, the symbol of spirit descending into incarnation, and the symbol of the return of that spirit to its own inevitable destiny, the return to its royal home, however often we stumble on the way, and so delay the speed of that return. Churim, or Kurim. We have seen that the four elements are referred to the ego, or intuition, emotion, reason, and will, or, as some place the order differently, the four human possibilities to know, to will, to dare, and to keep silent. If we place the ego, intuition, as fire, and reason, mind, as air, at opposite ends of the vertical axis, and emotion as water, and will as earth at opposite ends of the horizontal axis, we shall have some clue to one factor in the behavior of human beings. Man normally is influenced on the lower plane by his will, and on the higher plane by his reason, whereas woman is influenced on the lower plane by her emotion, and the higher plane by her intuition. Thus, the pairs of opposites can be traced in their effect on the behavior as normal reaction, and to be in perfect balance, it is necessary for each to cultivate the fundamental characteristics of the other. We know that will without emotion leads to tyranny, to the dictator of the present day, and to all forms of oppression, while emotion without will is unstable as water, leading to mass hysteria and many of the troubles of our modern large cities. On the other hand, intuition without reason becomes sterile unless translated into action. And reason without intuition can be cold and hard, as is evident in so much of our present-day materialism. Each element alone leads to unbalance in the human being, who is still out of balance in proportion, as that being is ruled by any one element at the expense of the other three. In the language of alchemy, the elements were called sulfur, or fire, mercury, air, salt, water, and earth, and the chemical process of the alchemists had the object of converting things of the earth into those of the higher realms. As we read on the Emerald Tablet of Hermes, quote, "It is true, no lie, certain, and to be depended upon, the superior agrees with the inferior, and the inferior with the superior, to the effect that one truly wonderful work," end quote. This is the basis of the teaching of the mystery system throughout the ages. And it is also the teaching of our modern Freemasonry, that the whole of creation is one. Man cannot live by bread alone, just as we cannot imagine a positive pole of electric battery without having a negative pole somewhere or other. So are what we call heaven and earth opposite ends of Jacob's ladder, and all men are brothers. Thus the hurt of one can be the harm of all. As our ritual so aptly puts it, quote, "The level demonstrates that we are all sprung from the same stock, partakers of the same nature, and sharers of the same hope. And although distinctions among men are necessary to preserve subordination, yet ought no eminence of situation make us forget that we are brothers." End quote. The word subordination may well give rise to false ideas, either of pride in those of high rank or offense in those who have not yet reached high rank. But the meaning in the older dictionaries is given as dependence of persons or things with respect to or upon one another. In the same dictionary, there is an interpretation of the word ordinate as applied to geometrical figures, saying that these are the quote-unquote same as regular ones, examples being They are equilateral and equal angular, end quote. And one other thought on this subject, we know that the word sub means below, and that the normal meaning of the word ordination means the act of ordaining or putting into holy orders. Can we not see the veiled reference to our duties in this world below, in our sublunary abode as part of the consecrated work of the great architect and the great family, each member of which is dependent on all others? In these modern days, we hear so much talk about freedom and about the rights of men, but so little about their duties and responsibilities. When, at the early stage of our initiation ceremony, we are asked, "Are you a free man?" we follow almost immediately by binding the candidate to a rigid code of conduct and discipline, with the obligation that he is no longer free, but in future must work for the good of all. This is one of the fundamental teachings of our order, that although the fellow craft is to be known and proved by the square, yet is that square only a part of a greater whole? It is, as we say, but the fourth part of the great circle of life. In the book of Manly P. Hall entitled Masonic, Hermetic, Kabbalistic, and Rosicrucian Symbolical Philosophy, the following passage refers to the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Quote, "When the first seal was broken, there rode forth a man on a white horse wearing a crown and holding in his hand a bow. When the second seal was broken, there rode forth a man on a red horse, and in his hand was a great sword. When the third seal was broken, there rode forth a man upon a black horse with a pair of balances in his hand. And when the fourth seal was broken, there rode forth Death upon a pale horse, and Hell followed after him." The four horsemen of the apocalypse may be interpreted to signify the four main divisions of human life. Birth is represented by the rider on the white horse, who comes forth conquering, and to conquer the impetuosity of youth, by the rider of the red horse, who took peace from the earth, maturity by the rider on the black horse, who weighs all things in the scales of reason, and death by the rider on the pale horse, who was given power over a fourth part of earth. In Eastern philosophy, these horsemen signify the four yugas, our ages of the world, which riding forth at their appointed times become a certain span, the rulers of creation. End quote. The four yugas, or periods of time, are described in the East as follows. See Isis Unveiled, H.P. Blavatsky. Krita Yuga, the Golden Age, the age of joy and spiritual innocence of man. Treta Yuga, the age of silver, the period of the supremacy of man, of giants, and of the sons of God. Dvapara Yuga, the age of bronze, of mixture of purity and impurity, spirit and matter, the age of doubt. Kali Yuga, our present age, the age of iron, of darkness, misery, and sorrow. Kali is the best emblem to represent the quote-unquote fall of man, the fall of spirit into the matter, with its terrific and far-reaching results. It is said that these four yugas represent also the psychological and mental states of man, as well as the physical states, during the period of their reign. The Greek mystics also recognized four ages, the Golden Age, the Silver Age, the Bronze Age, and the Iron Age. These were metaphysical expressions referring to the four major periods in the life of all things. In the divisions of the day, they refer to dawn, midday, sunset, and midnight. In the duration of the gods, men, and universes, they denote the periods of birth, maturity, decay, or dissolution, and withdrawal. Even so, when we say that the square is but the fourth part of a circle, which is subtended by four right angles, are we not saying that no one part of the whole, the cosmos, can exist without all the remainder? If we really understood this teaching, we should recognize that what we call physical death is but the opposite facet of physical birth, and that one leads to the other according to the universal law. But if this law really is universal, then physical death must lead to rebirth on some plane of existence, even as the dawn follows the sunset. Perhaps we are too deeply rooted in materialism to recognize that rebirth does not of necessity imply return to this planet, which we call Earth, nor does it imply that we shall again put on the quote-unquote coats of skin, which in the book of Genesis refer to the enclosure of flesh, what we call the human body, in which the divine spirit was confined when, as we read in the book, quote-unquote, man became a living soul. That soul is a manifestation of the divine being on this plane of existence, and, therefore, each human being is a positive aspect of the same divine being. If we really could understand that every person we meet is a manifestation of the Supreme Being, however imperfect that person may appear to our imperfect eyes, the divisions and dissensions of this world would assume a very different meaning than they have now. Is it a coincidence that we arbitrarily distinguish four main types of color in the people of this world? We speak of men as being black, white, yellow, brown, and surely each one of these types is essential for the balance of world progress. No one should or can be dominant because each one is a manifestation of the divine spirit. Or, in the words of our ritual, each one is the fourth part of a circle, the circle of the zodiac, the circle of humanity, and the circle of the spirit, which has neither beginning nor end. Let us remember always that although each stone in the temple of the Most High may be of different form than the rest, that temple will be incomplete if even one stone is missing or is imperfect, for the strength of the whole structure is that of its weakest link. In closing, let us remember those significant words of Rudyard Kipling in his poem, My New Cut Ashlar, Then Boy to Life's Handicap. One stone, the more swings into place. In that dread temple of thy worth, it is enough that, through thy grace, I saw not common on thy earth. Take not that vision from my ken. Oh, whatsoever may spoil or speed, help me to need no aid from men, that I may help such men as need. Peace to all beings. And that concludes the fourth part of a circle. You know, as we read the first part, it was heavy on the idea of astrological symbolism, which I find so interesting, mostly because I really don't understand a lot of it, and it is something that I am trying to remedy. Now, I've had long conversations with people who are adept in this way of thinking, but usually the issue is to get those people to talk to me in a way that facilitates my dumb brain. You know, large vocabulary words and things don't work well for me. But what I find is that a lot of the texts that are written about on the subject of astrology tend to be words that mean very interesting things. They are archaic words that are mystical sounding or what have you. And the challenge really should be for those types of things to be broken down into rational words that we use today to describe the things that are happening. And how to maybe use those techniques like astrology. And as we moved through the paper, there started to be, I find the best part of this paper in what we read in this episode, where it draws it back to the idea of Freemasonry and really describes the idea of the fourth part of the circle as a realization of a unity between all things. The all is one type of argument. Also, as I'm reading this, I can't help but think of the chapter on immortality from the book The Master's Lectures from Evans Lodge. There's a lot to be unpacked there, but the idea of moving from one plane of existence into another, it's the old thought experiment when your kid asks, you know, where do you go when you die? You can ask them the same question, where were you before you were born? I've asked my daughter, who is 5, I've asked all my kids, you know, when they were younger, I said, do you remember where you were before you were here? It's interesting. They stop. They think. My daughter says she was eating ice cream. I mean, so go figure, whatever that means. But it is an interesting way to think about the transition from one plane of existence to the next. Anybody who has heard my apotheosis and quantum entanglement lecture knows where I stand on ideas of moving from one plane to the next, and I go into detail about that in a physics-based presentation. But back to this paper, I mean, what a lengthy and interesting piece. I dare say this could be turned into a book, the first half of which would be a discourse on the tetramorph from astrology, from an astrological point of view, and moving through, you know, each chunk of this, you know, even a section perhaps on the yugas and something else. But in it, the author, Brother J.D. Blakely, references other issues, other transactions that had come out, which if I can find, I will certainly read those. But I hope you guys enjoyed. I will have the entire paper as a PDF document within the app. If you don't know how to get the app, then just head on over to Google Play or the App Store on your Apple device and search for the Podcast Source application. Once you download that, you can search for Whence Came You while you're inside and add it to your shows. You'll see a little kind of ellipsis soft key button that'll allow you to click that and download the bonus features in the app. It'll look like a little present. You click, tap on that button, and it'll open up, and you'll see the PDF there for you. That way you can check this out and run references on it as you need to. And the second piece I want to read for you this week is not a long one, but it is a really great piece. It comes from Brother Brian L. Pettis, 33rd degree, and he's an emeritus contributor over at the Midnight Freemasons, and he wrote a piece a few weeks ago called Working on Your Rough Ashlar. Let's get into it. Working on my rough ashlar is a phrase used by Freemasons to mean they are trying to apply the lessons of the fraternity to improve themselves in some way, perhaps morally or spiritually or hopefully and most importantly behaviorally. Freemasons using this phrase are indicating that they are trying to change something about themselves, trying to change how they behave. You have probably heard this or even used it yourself. But what does it really mean? Do we ever really change ourselves, especially our behavior, or do we just pat ourselves on the back for the good men, the perfect ashlars we already are? Let's look at the ritual. The rough ashlar, in the first degree, is that stone taken from the quarry in its rude and natural state, to remind us of our own rude and natural state. The rough ashlar is made ready, or perfected, to be of use to the builder in the constructing of his temple. How does this happen? For operative masons, the rough ashlar is perfected by subtraction. The common gavel is used to break off the rough and superfluous, or unnecessary, parts, leaving only the beautiful and useful behind. The symbolism is clear, but do we see ourselves in it? Do we see that we are the rude and imperfect rough ashlar that needs to be perfected to fortify and support the building of our own temples? Do we see the rough and superfluous parts that we need to break off and get rid of? Do we see that we have behavior that needs to change? I think an honest look in the mirror will tell us that we don't. When you look in the mirror, do you see a man who is full of pride or a mason who has humility? Do you see a man who clings to and defends his every opinion or a mason who keeps his mind open? Do you see a man who regularly provokes others to anger or despair or a mason who is more circumspect? Do you see a man who would fight every fight, no matter how petty, or a mason who walks away? Do you see a man who sees things only from his point of view, or a mason who seeks to understand and easily empathizes with another? Do you see a man who demonizes those with whom he disagrees, or a mason who recognizes that the divine which lives within him lives within them as well? So look in the mirror. Do you see the mason you want to be, or the man you don't? Better yet, look at your Facebook, your Twitter, social media, your posts, and your comments. Do you see there the man that you want people to think of when they think of Freemasonry? If not, get to work with your gavel. Break off and subtract those superfluous parts, your passions and prejudices. Change your behavior and change your heart. Get rid of the rubbish that you need to remove so that the man that you are can become the mason you want to be. My brother, now more than ever, your country needs you to do this. Your fraternity and your lodge needs you to do this, and most importantly, you need you to do this. If you think that you don't, what are you doing here? Brian L. Pettis, 33rd degree. I just think this is a wonderful piece, because while we're reading this, we necessarily think, yeah, I'm definitely full of humility, but are we? Do we remember that when we're out there doing the thing, when we're getting introduced, when we're having drinks or cocktails or cigars or whatever we're doing, in all the pomp and circumstance, and when we think we're, you know, this awesome gentlemanly society, are we still remembering what we have to work on? I highly doubt this comes into mind. I was having a conversation this last weekend. I think it was on another podcast where I was a guest. And we got on the topic of putting yourselves in interesting situations and avoiding bad paths. And the example we started to talk about was this idea of going to a party. Before you even go to a work party, do you say to yourself, two drinks and no more? And when you're at the party, you have those two drinks, and when somebody is ready to pour you a third, you actually say, nope, I'm good. Thank you, though. Or do you just keep on drinking and put yourself at risk, maybe embarrassing yourself later or what have you? The idea that I'm trying to convey here is that oftentimes we are at odds with who we are at other points in our life, even earlier in the same day. At some point in the day, we might think one way about ourselves, and then later, when we're in the moment, we somehow justify an inappropriate action that the self from earlier in the day would have looked down upon incredibly. So in this, it's really time to reflect. It's really time to listen to yourself. And when you make rules for yourself to be better, to not do this, to not do that, to be conscious enough to not put yourself in a situation to disappoint your higher self, to keep yourself from being put in those situations altogether. So it requires some intuition, perhaps some amalgamation of the four tenets: prudence, fortitude, justice, temperance. But let's work on ourselves so that we don't disappoint our higher selves. That's it for this week. I hope you guys really enjoyed a shorter episode, but I promise next week is going to be amazing. We're going to have Brother Angel Millar on the program, and we'll be talking about this latest issue, incredible issue, of the Fraternal Review and masonry and fashion. This is going to be an incredible conversation. I hope you join us next week for that. And thank you all so much for listening to the program. Thanks to our contributors, our fellows, and our producers. We can't do this show week after week without you. If you want to be among those people that we thank every week for this amazing opportunity that we have to bring Masonic education to Masons and the profane alike, week after week, month after month, year after year, head on over to WCYpodcast.com, click on support the show to see how you can help. And lastly, if you are interested in any of the items from MasonicCon Chicago, if you want to own a little piece of history, head on over to MasonicConChicago.com to see how you can get one of the last 50 coins or 50 pins we have left. That's it, everybody. I hope you all have an amazing week. Take care. Stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.